This episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/Sherlock. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Also, the Wessex Press, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wessexpress.com. And the Baker Street Journal, the leading publication of Sherlockian scholarship since 1946. Subscriptions available at bakerstreetjournal.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, Episode 64, Sherlock Holmes in Translation.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became a chronicler.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Baker Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Wolder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
And welcome once more to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees, where it's always 1895. I'm Scott Monty.
And I'm Burt Wolder.
And together, we are blue, unlike Violet Hunter, to welcome you. We're blue with pleasure to welcome you here once again to our little chat, our little car talk for Sherlockians, as it's been called, where we discuss the goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes and talk to some of the luminaries who make it the extra special place that it is.
But don't drive like my brother.
And don't drive like my brother. But this is great because, first of all, we are recording on Star Wars Day. Mm. And may the 4th be with you.
Okay, may the 4th be with you too.
And it was nice to be with you on May the 2nd. We were both just in Boston for the annual Speckled Band of Boston dinner.
How wonderful. Yeah, it was such a treat because we talk all the time, but we seldom see each other, and it's wonderful. I was thrilled that you were able to make it, and also Chris Music. It was great to have Chris there, and we had such a nice turnout for the band meeting. It was really grand.
It was a great turnout, and it's ironic. I have to go to New York and now Boston, evidently, to see my fellow Detroiter, Chris Music. But we saw people that we see just once a year at that same gathering. But we also saw one of our biggest fans, Jim O'Leary.
Yes.
And it was really wonderful to finally press the flesh and get a chance to chat a little bit with
him. You had not met James before?
No, I hadn't. Yeah. So, and I know he was the designated driver for Dr. Constable. So,
yes.
You know, the keeper emeritus was in his hands.
Yes.
And evidently he forced Dr. Constable to listen to one of our episodes on the way in. So I'm not surprised that he looked so feeble and wan.
Oh, I didn't know that. I wonder which one they heard.
I think they said they listened to episode 63 with Andy and Bob Katz.
Oh, well, it's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, very good. Well, James had a lot of good suggestions, as usual, for the podcast, and we'll see if we can put some of those into practice.
Yeah, I'm hoping we will. And in the meantime, if you folks haven't had an opportunity, you can reach us everywhere. We are labeled I Hear of Sherlock online, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr. Of course, we have a Scoop It site where we clip Sherlock Holmes news items and throw them in there. The Sherlock Holmes community on Google Plus now has over 1,500 members. People keep joining there, and there you can see all of the categories there on the Sherlock Holmes community: general discussion, the original stories, scholarship, pastiches and parodies. Then we get into things like photos and artwork. There's a lot of visuals there, just beautiful visuals on the site. You can talk about or share news about Conan Doyle or the BSI, and then Cumberbatch, Elementary, Granada, any of the movies. If there isn't a category for you to find that's related to Sherlock Holmes on the Google Plus community, then, well, it's probably not happening.
That's right.
So check that out. And of course, if you'd like to get in touch with us, there are a couple of ways to do that, right, Bert?
Yes. Yeah, rumor is good. Money. Anyone who writes a tip or a suggestion for a podcast and mails it to me, scrawled on the back of a $5 bill, will get an immediate thank you. But also, you can call us at 774-221-READ. That's 774-221-7323. You can email us, comment at ihearofsherlock.com. You can post comments of all sorts and sizes on the ihearofsherlock.com website. And but of all of those options, scrawling things on the back of bills of any denomination is the one that appeals to me most right now.
Or a coconut.
Yes.
If you're really up for a challenge. And tie it to the foot of an unladen swallow.
Well, yes. But is that a South American swallow or is that a Javanese?
A European swallow. That's right. I don't know. Well, enough of this silliness. Enough of this silliness. No, let's get into the next batch of silliness. We've got a wonderful show for you on episode 64. We're creeping back into the collector's corner. You may recall that we've had a few individuals on over the course of our history. Certainly the most memorable, I think, were Jerry Margolin on episode 16 and Otto Penzler on episode 17. And occasionally we come across these people who have an extraordinary appetite for a particular area of Sherlockiana, something that they're passionate about, something that drives their interest in Sherlock Holmes, and they own it like no one else. And there was one individual who has since passed who had this particular fixation, shall we call it. His name was Fred Levin, and our next guest, who is about to join us, picked up the mantle. I know Fred was a great mentor to him, but we're going to talk with him about exactly what it is that he's interested in collecting and why he is so fervent about it. The gentleman of whom I am speaking is one Mr. Don Hobbs, BSI, who is Inspector Lestrade. Don, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Scott. Hi, Bert. Can you hear me?
Yes, you sound good.
Fantastic. And we should also mention this is Don's first time on Skype as part of a podcast kind of thing. So you're doing great, Don.
Yeah, that's right. You've been very gentle, and I appreciate that very much.
Where are you joining us from this evening?
I am actually sitting in my library in Flower Mound, Texas.
Flower Mound. And how is it down in Texas?
Oh, it was only about 80 degrees today and sunny, and I was doing pool work outside today, so aww. I've been a busy body.
We sympathize with you.
I know. It's life is rough, but someone has to do it.
That's great. Well, you used to be known before you joined the BSI, and you were given an investiture in the BSI in 2012, is that correct?
That is correct. That's okay. Right. That's right. I was which seems shocked. Like if you've known me, as you've known me for a long time, it's hard to make me speechless. And that evening, I was totally speechless.
Those are always the most wonderful, really.
That was very true.
And you're one of those guys where you got your investiture, and I thought, what? Don wasn't already part of the BSI? You've just been part of our community for so long.
For years. I think you and I were at one of our first dinners together back the when Tom Styx resigned.
Yeah.
I was at that dinner, and you and I were at the same table with Peter Blau.
Yeah.
And then there was I had my own great hiatus, so to speak. And it was about 14 years before I was invited back to the dinner. I think that things just fall through the cracks, and but I kept plying my trade, and you know, it's the great Sisyphus. I finally made it to the top, and I didn't have to go back down and push the ball back up to the top.
Well, I know we do want to hear a little bit about your Sherlockian origins, but before we get to that, you were most widely known online prior to your investiture as the Maniac Collector. Why would that be?
Well, back in the day, back in the late 90s or the mid 90s, I was laid up through a medical procedure, and I wasn't able to get out and visit. And I was good friends with John Bennett Shaw. And we were talking about something to do, and I came up with the collector from the illustrious client. I said, you know, he has the collection mania in its most acute form, and especially on that subject, which he is an authorized authority. And John just thought that was great. So I became kind of the Maniac Collector. What I did then was I started the world's first International Collectors Society. And what I would do at the time is I would find, you know, like library copies or used copies of the canon in English, and I would send them to other people in other countries, and I'd say, look at what I sent you and send me something in equal value. And that's kind of the way I started collecting. I had gone to John's house and I just recently had bought my first two translations. I bought a Polish and a Spanish edition, and when John was showing me his wall of books from everything from Afrikaans to Yiddish, I gloated and said, you know, I got this Polish edition. John looked at me and he did not have that edition, nor did he have the Spanish edition. And I thought, how could this possibly be all these books and everything? And he did not have these. And so at the time, John Shaw had 60 translated languages that the canon had been translated into. And I had two of them. So I thought, well, hell, it can't be that bad to get 58 more. What is that? 30 years later, I'm still looking for two of those original 60 languages.
Which two are you still looking for?
I'm looking for Kazakh and Telugu of those original 60s. Now, of those 60, I've found 40 more languages that the canon has been translated into, bringing the total to 100.
Wow.
And that's I was real excited this week. A friend from Japan sent me a message about an Occitani translation of The Hound of the Baskervilles, and I got real excited thinking this was the 101st language. And as I dug deeper, I found out that Occitani is another is also called Gascon, which is a language they speak in the Andorian region of France and a little bit in Portugal and a little bit in Spain. And I already had the Gascon translations. They had just – the hound was spelled differently. They had a Gascoa instead of Leoa or some – you know, it was some minute detail. But when I dug further, I found the translator was the same. It was the same language. So there's still just 100 languages that the canon has been translated into.
Wow.
I have 96 of those languages.
And are you fluent in many of these languages?
I am. I can barely speak English. Though I talk good. The thing is I keep a lot of bibliographic information on all of my books, and when you're dealing with a Roman alphabet, it's easy to figure out who the translator, where the city of the publication, the name of the publisher, and all that. It's just when you get into Cyrillic or Armenian or Georgian alphabets that you have a little bit of difficulty. The internet is a marvelous tool that you can use with Google Translate and other things, but I have developed a small army of assistants and people that help me all over the world with different alphabets, and I can find a book in Bengali, and I have a contact in the Bengali Association of America that will translate that for me. I'll send them the copy of the bibliographic page. They will tell me the story, the content, the publisher, and all that stuff. So I have this army of people that help me do this.
Kind of like the irregulars.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Wow. And do you travel internationally so you get to actually make stops at, you know, bookstores in some exotic cities?
Yeah. Now, for the last 10 years, I worked for a software company based in San Diego. I'm no longer associated with that job, but I did travel a lot with that. I traveled in Asia and all over the United States with that job. But that allowed me to accumulate 1.5 million miles on American Airlines. So I can use that. I've been to both the No Fog Country meetings, the one in Barcelona and the one in Venice 2 years ago. I was in Portugal. I do travel a lot internationally and go to bookstores and find things and always seem to find people that are willing to help me find foreign translations of the canon. I only collect the canon in translation. I know there's lots of pastiches and you know, like the dime novels that were published in many of the countries at the turn of the century, and they eventually evolved into the Harry Taxon Harry Dixon. I don't know. But anyway, I only concentrate on canonical works. I figure if I'm going to spend lots of money on books I can't read, at least I should know what they are. Does that kind of make sense? I know that's kind of idiomatic logic, isn't it?
No, it does. It does. And look, I think there's too many pastiches in English. So, to try to collect them in other languages, that would be...
Yeah.
Just horrible.
But so, Don, you've got many more books than just those examples of the canon in 100 different languages. I've read you have something like 11,000 books in your library.
Yeah, I have just a little over 11,000. I've got my collection habits has gone in really weird things. I've always collected foreign translations, but there was a point in the 90s where I was collecting signed publications, and Les Klinger helped me publish a book that we did back in 99 on signed publications. And then I decided that I wanted to collect all the different variations of the canon, which so I would get all the Strand magazines and all the everything. So I have lots and lots and lots of books. Then I went to a period where I was gathering all the higher criticisms and like early on, like a lot of collectors, you know, I did collect a lot of pastiches. So I've got probably 700 or 800 pastiches. I've got, 1,000 books on higher criticisms, and I've got about 5,000, variations of the canon, and about 3,200 of that is in translation. So yeah, I do have a library that's thorough. I did model it after John Bennett Shaw's library, the way it's set up. But I've gone way overboard in the last 5 years. I have bought very little outside of foreign translation, and my foreign translation has gotten to be very complete and very well-rounded. I keep finding these dealers. I have got a guy right now in Hungary that about every month sends me 2 or 3 books from the turn of the century. So I must have 40 or 50 turn of the century, 1900 to 1915 Hungarian translations, the complete run in all the different sets. I've got the same in Spanish and Japanese and Russian, and it just goes on and on and on. It's amazing how many books there are in translation.
And of all of those, do you have a particular favorite?
You know, I get that question a lot, and I do. There was a circa 1930 Valencian translation. There was a whole series in the very nice Art Nouveau covers, and there's this blue and white with the Hound of the Baskervilles, and it's got these red flames that comes out over his head going all the way out into infinity. They're really a wonderful set of books. All of them are very, very nice, but just the Hound is one of my very favorites. It's just a nice cover. The artwork in that whole series is great. But I mean, I have so many weird things that I've got all these turn of the century Finnish editions that have all the Europeans have marvelous artwork, and the artwork stands alone. Even if it wasn't canonical, I think the artwork sometimes is just fabulous, the way that these illustrators and these designers in the, especially in the 20s and the 30s, they really were into this stuff.
Is there any artwork that doesn't necessarily seem to match the actual story? Like, I mean, we're all used to the Paget illustrations and the famous book covers and whatnot, but are there any that you've seen that you look at it and you go, well, why would they pick that for an illustration?
Yeah, actually, it's interesting that you mentioned that. I have going back to this gentleman in Budapest in Hungary, I just got a hound. It was from 1907. It was a hound of the Baskervilles. And the hound looks more like a cross between an iguana and Godzilla. It's a very dinosaur or reptilian looking creature. It doesn't match anything that you've ever seen on the hounds before. But again, I have, when you look at some of my Indian, like my Bengali, my Gujarati, my Marathi translations of Sherlock Holmes, the illustrations, Sherlock Holmes looks very Indian. The Chinese edition, he looks very Chinese. It's interesting that whichever culture is translating, Sherlock Holmes has amazing ability to take on that ethnicity.
Yeah. Interesting. So, Don, why don't you take us back to yesteryear, if you will.
Yesteryear.
How did you first meet Sherlock Holmes?
Well, I've always been a collector of books, and I was interested in Sherlock Holmes from an early age. I'd read Sherlock Holmes, and you know, when I was young, I thought Sherlock Holmes was a real person, and it took me until I was in my 20s or maybe 30s to realize that he was a real person, and then I went from there. Now, I gave a talk at the University of Minnesota back in August about kind of the origins of my collection. I was collecting back in the early 80s and the mid 80s. I was collecting Stephen King books, and in my brilliant wisdom, I thought, well, these books I spent $20 and $60 on were selling between $200 and $700 a piece. I decided that no living author could sustain that kind of price. And now those same books are selling for $2,500 and $3,000. But that's beside the point. At the time, I was married to a woman from Britain, and I was going to England about a month every year. And after I sold my Stephen King collection, I had quite a large sum of money, and we went to England, and I went to Murder One there in Charing Cross in London, and I bought some books. And then where my ex-wife is from was near Hay-on-Wye, the used bookstore capital of the world there in the Wye Valley in Wales. And I went there, and I was able to buy about 50 different Sherlock Holmes books. I bought some Strand magazines, the single issues, and all this. And I was really interested in the Sherlock Holmes mythos. And like I said, at the time, I thought he was a real person. And it took me a while to realize that he was. And so I ended up with about 30 or 40 books, and I bought more books. And the next thing I know, I had about 500 different books. And a lot of those were pastiches in some of the early Baker Street journals. And one day I get a phone call from John Bennett Shaw. I'd also discovered the Dallas, the Crew of the Barcelona Star, which was the Dallas Society at the time. And I had started going to those meetings. And then John called me and invited me to go to Moriarty, to the Unhappy Birthday Moriarty You Bastard celebration. And the first time I went there, I was, like I said, I was a budding Sherlockian collector. I had about 500 books and nothing very much other than that. I did have a first edition mint condition of the Misadventures of Sherlock Holmes. And I met Rhonda Wall, and I met Saul Cohen, I met John Shaw, I met Dorothy Shaw, I met all these crazy people. I said, these are the craziest people. I want to be like these people. And from that point on, that was in the mid 80s, and I've really been collecting and concentrating ever since.
That's great. So you mentioned the Crew of the Bark Lone Star. That's,
yes.
That's a Texas Sherlockian society.
Right. I don't know. I'm sure you remember Francine Swift, the late, great Francine Swift and Wayne Swift. Francine was from Greenville, Texas, and she was one of the co-founders with John Shaw. And that was kind of the early days when there was the Johnny Appleseed of Sherlockania that John and was going around and creating societies everywhere. So the Dallas Society was the Crew of the Barcelona Star, and Margaret Swift, at the time, her name was Margaret Pettit, and she became, you know, before she married Wayne and became, you know, she went from Margaret Pettit, I think, to Francine Swift or something of that. I might have the names wrong, but anyway, she was one of the founders of our society, and that was, of course, it's taken from the Five Orange Pips. There was societies in Fort Worth and societies in Houston and Austin. They were all very active back in, this was in the early 70s, and I didn't come onto the scene until the early 80s or the mid 80s is when I joined the scene. So. Okay.
And is it a group you're still affiliated with now?
Yes. Now, what happened was there was the Sherlockian Society, was the crew of the Barcelona Star, and then there was there happened to be a Sherlockian. We won't mention any names, but he was a member of that society that kind of was mean and no one cared much for. So there was a small group of us that we started a offshoot of that called the Diogenes Club of Dallas. We call it that because we didn't talk about that to the other members, and so we were all consultants. And had Friday afternoons off, and so we started meeting at this little bar on Friday afternoons and having Sherlockian meetings. And eventually, the mean person moved away, and the crew kind of went into what we call dry dock. And the Diogenes Club for about 15 years was the predominant Sherlockian society here in Dallas-Fort Worth area. And then only in the last year, the crew of the Barcelona Star has been reestablished, and the Diogenes Club has kind of ceased to exist. I mean, they're still in existence, but they're not meeting. So now everything is back under the crew of the Barcelona Star. It's kind of the revised crew. I'm kind of their mentor or their spiritual advisor. But it's a whole new set of Sherlockians, young, enthusiastic Sherlockians, and they're doing really good. They've got good plans, and they're enthusiastic, which we all need in this Sherlockian world.
Yeah, and it sounds like they're very lucky to have a mentor such as yourself.
I try, but, you know, like I said to you off air, my reputation far exceeds my abilities.
Don, have you ever collected anything else?
I like to say that there are two sorts of people in the world. Those with the collecting gene and without the collecting gene. And I definitely fall into the former category. As far back as I can remember, I've collected something. I mean, I collected rocks and I collected coins and I collected stamps and small reptiles and girls' phone numbers and record albums and Stephen King. And so now I'm an old man. I just collect Sherlock Holmes. And so, yeah, I've always collected something, and I think that you'll find that most people that are collectors have always collected something.
And have you moved on and dispensed with prior collections? Have you?
Yes, I have. I'm lucky that my house, I've got a large house, and my wife and I are empty nesters. So I have the upstairs library, and then the middle son's bedroom has now become the overflow library, and downstairs is another library. We still collect a lot of books. My wife and I both are big readers. She collects cookbooks, travel books, fiction books. We have really the workings now of three libraries in our house with probably 15,000 or more books in this house. So we don't want to ever move, but then again, we don't have to. We don't have to buy insulation because our walls are very thermal significant.
So, Don, you mentioned earlier, you mentioned your ex-wife and now your current wife. There was, it seems like either way that you've had a marriage of convenience. You know, you had the access to Murder One and the used bookstore capital of England, and now you've got someone who shares your life who also shares your love of books. I don't think one can get much luckier than that.
No, I'm very lucky there. My wife Joyce and I, we actually have known each other for 40 years. We worked together at the hospital together, and then she went off and got married, and I went off and got married. And then, you know, when we both ended up in divorce in the early 90s, we kind of hit back off. But she never says, you know, why do you need so many books? She doesn't care about that. She collects dishes, she collects towels, she collects linens, and so, you know, it's a perfect relationship that she collects what she wants, I collect what I want. She never, you know, as long as we pay our bills, what do we care? You know, we're both in the firm theory that we don't want to leave anything to our kids' inheritance. We want to spend it all. And what better way to spend your money on books that you can't read? I mean, that's what I say. I mean, that's not quite the theory, but it's funny. I mean, we've been married for 20 years now, and we had a dinner party here back right around Christmas time, and she pulls out a set of dishes that I've never seen. I said, "Where did these come?" Oh, they've been in the cabinet for years. But I could pull out books here that she's never seen. So it's like I said, it's a perfect symbiotic relationship. We we do what we are, and she travels for her job and I travel for my job. So we always like to say that we function very well together, but we also function very well apart. And that's a big part of life. And a lot of people are so codependent, or, you know, it's if we're together, we're together. If we're not together, we know that it's all part of, you know, the big plan. So,
Now you mentioned kind of half in jest about not wanting to leave anything to your kids.
That's kind of
what's going to become of your collection eventually? I mean, will you entrust your kids as executors to know how to dole out this great collection, or what's your intention?
Well, that's changed recently. I have I have a son who's 30, and he's on the 10-year plan of college, and he had a sidetrack of 2.5 years in Iraq and some serious issues there, and now he's about to graduate with his degree in petroleum engineering, or I'm sorry, in geology, and he's been accepted for his master's in petroleum engineering. Wow. So he actually we were together today, and he is starting to become a Sherlockian, and he wants to spend time learning when he finishes school in another 2 years, when he gets his master's. He wants to start learning about the Sherlock Holmes world, the collecting, and he would like to inherit my books and take it to the next level, be the second generation of the foreign language Hobbes collection. So that really makes me proud, and it's something because we were talking about, you know, I know that Tom Sticks and his son and Edgar Smith and his son, I mean, they were kind of Sherlockians that followed their father's footsteps, but there's not that many great Sherlockian collectors. Not that I'm a great collector, I just have a lot of books and can't I read. But I mean, there's not a lot of people that follow in, you know. You can't make someone, I mean, if you wanted your son to drive a Ford, and if he wanted to drive a Chevrolet, you're not going to be able to make him drive that, right? And it's the same thing. Is it's really good that he wants to do that. He said to me today, he said, you know, you spent 30 years or so putting this collection together. It needs to be continued. And that really made me proud to hear my son say that. I didn't think he could be that mature, but sometimes they surprise you, don't they?
Well, I think you raised him right, Don. And, you know, sometimes it takes them a while to come around. And like you said, you can't force it on them. And instills you with great pride and just a sense of well-being, knowing that they want to do this. And you know, it is a rarity, you know, to be able to look at multi-generational Sherlockians. We don't see too many of them. And I know he doesn't have many, or doesn't have any children of his own, but you should probably introduce your son to Peter Blau, who himself was a petrochemical geologist, so there'd be a line to continue there as well with the practical but limited geologist.
That's right. We can do that. Because Dean Clark, who is also a Tulsa Sherlockian that spends half his time here in Dallas, and you know he published the magazine of SEG, the Southwest Geological Survey, and we're introducing him to these people, but there's a lot of Sherlockians in this realm so if we can take the next generation, it would be good. Hopefully in the next couple of years I will start bringing him to New York with me and start introducing him to the crowds, and so we shall see.
Yeah, you were, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was either, I think it was last year, the 2013 dinner, it was announced that you were appointed as the general editor of the Baker Street Irregulars International series. Is that correct?
That is correct. What happened was the Spanish, the Amateur Mendicant Society in Madrid, they sent a Michael Whalen a set of essays. There's about 22 Spanish essays. They said, here, we don't want anything to do with them. And they kind of washed their hands of them. They were not in great, all of them were not in the best format. Some of them were just copies, PDF copies of PDF files, and they were just horrible. And Michael asked me about 3 years, maybe even 4 years ago now, if I would be willing to help get those edited from Spanish into English. And since I have a great network of friends in Barcelona in Spain, I've been working on that. And then early last year, Michael called and said, you know, would you be willing to be the general editor of this? And I was honored, and I said I would. So we have got the 22, we've got 20 of the 22 essays translated into English now, and we have 11 of them in the final edited stage. We've gone through and edited the context and got them in format, and so we've got 10 more to go. There's a couple more that needs to be finished, and I'm in preliminary works right now with Peter Calamai to do the next international series to follow the Spanish with the Canada and Sherlock Holmes. So yes, I am the general editor of the international series.
Well, hopefully the translating for Canada won't be as rigorous as that for Spain.
I know it may not be. No, how many? Yeah, Peter's a great newspaper editor, and that's going to be an easy task for me. I just stay back, and we've been working back and forth. We had a meeting in New York when I was there, but the Spanish is going good. We spend about 4 hours a week editing these papers, and I've got Dean Clark, who is an editor professional that I said that was the managing editor for the Southwest Geological Survey in Tulsa, who's helping me do my editorship on that. So once I get them in format, I'll get them up to John Burquist, and we're planning on publishing that in having them finished by December of this year, and then having them the for the BSI weekend of 2016 have the next international series coming out.
Fantastic. And how special is it too that you're working on the Spanish edition when you were originally in John Bennett Shaw's library, knowing that you had a Spanish version of the canon?
I know, isn't that
alongside the
it
Polish?
It all comes full circle, doesn't it?
It really does.
It's amazing that I think back of that, and it was very ironic because I got my invitation to come to Santa Fe, and the week before I'd gone down to Austin, Texas, to a book fair, and I went into this book fair, and there was a Polish edition. And the guy said he'd take $5 for it because I said, why? And he said, well, it's Polish and Sherlock Holmes can't figure out how to solve the mystery. And ha, ha, ha. And so the next table over was a Spanish edition. And when I got to John's house, I showed him, you know, I had these. And John had the same book, the same cover, the same publisher that was in English, but he'd never seen a Spanish copy of it. And so a few months later after that, I found a second copy and I was able to send it to John because, you know, his axiom was, if you have one of something, gloat. If you have more than one of something, share.
Yeah.
And it was really, it was a good relationship. And actually I became friends with Dorothy and that was his late wife. And then when Dorothy passed on, I inherited her Sherlocking collection. There's only about 40 books, but I ended up with the Dorothy Shaw's Sherlock Holmes collection, which is nice. It's sitting here in my library.
How special. That's lovely.
Now, it's been a good life. I've had a good run. I mean, Sherlockianian has been very, very good to me.
Yeah. Now, in addition to the bookstore owners and the network of eyes and ears that you have all around the world, do you regularly meet and greet and perhaps even stay with other Sherlockians when you travel?
I do. Michael Whalen called me the Johnny Appleseed of Sherlockania one time because with my I was just in March. I was working in West Virginia, so I got to go and visit Andy Fescue's library. If you've ever had the opportunity, that's probably the most amazing library I've ever seen in my life.
Why is that?
It's one of these libraries that you cannot put into words. It's not, I mean, the Sherlockania part of it is a very small part of it, but it's the most complete detective fiction library I've ever seen, from complete sets of everything. I mean, first editions, mint conditions of everything. It's just, I can't put it into words. I just, there's no way of describing Andy Fescue's library. It's amazing. Just to give you an idea, there's just the light setting. There's 16 different light settings that you can change to have the mood in the library change. Does that tell you what it's like? I mean, I can't describe. I mean, it's hard. I mean, but I've been to Peter Blau's many times in Tunlaw, and then when he moved to in Bethesda. I've been to Michael Keane's library. I've been to Ralph Hall's library. I've been to, like you mentioned earlier, Fred Levin's library. I've been to John Bennett Shaw's library, and a lot of this is due with my work, because I was working for a radiology software company that allowed me to travel all over. I've been in 48 continental states. I've been into several countries, Canada, Mexico, Japan, Hong Kong, Philippines, just a lot of work related. So, and then, like I said earlier, I get all these frequent flyer miles. So when I go on vacation, I go and visit other Sherlockians. If I'm close, I like to visit people and I enjoy looking at other people's libraries and seeing how mine compares or I did have a last year, Michael Meir, you know, Michael Meir from Switzerland.
Switzerland, yeah.
He was in Dallas for a copyright attorneys convention here in Dallas, and he came over and he was looking at my collection and he complimented me by saying that my German collection was more complete than his, and that's his native tongue.
Wow. That's amazing.
I can pull out treasures, but I do have it's hard to describe unless you see how many books there are in translation. Back to your question is I travel and if I know there's a Sherlockian in the area, so you know, beware if I'm ever up in Detroit area, I'll call you up and say, hey,
you'd better. You're going to be underwhelmed at my library, but
Everyone's different. I would like to, I'd like to do a photo book sometime of all the Sherlockian library. Just, you know, every collector and every library is different, and there's uniqueness in every single library. You don't have to have every first edition, but I mean, it's just the collection. It's the passion that shows through in individual collectors, I believe.
I like that. So thinking back, you know, as you consider all of the time and effort that it's taken you to accumulate your collection or to fine-tune your collection, and having seen some of these great libraries of Sherlockians that you just mentioned, what advice would you give to the burgeoning collector, perhaps somebody who is starting out in the world of Sherlockiana or who has already started but wants to refine? What advice would you give them as a collector?
The best advice I could think of is know your subject. I mean, when I first started out, you remember the 1948-49, the BSI did a limited and a trade edition of the Blue Carbuncle.
Sure, yeah.
So the first time I ever saw that, it was the first time I saw it, and I was excited. I paid $180 for the trade edition. It's probably worth 12, 15 bucks. Know your tradition and really, you know, a lot of collectors start out as the vacuum cleaner approach and that sucking up everything that's even related. But I think that quality as opposed to quantity or I'm not the best to say that because I have quantity. I mean, I'm a completist when it comes to foreign language. So I tried to have everything that's ever been published in foreign language. But if you find a niche market and learn as much as you can about that and make good sound decisions, it will pay off in the long run. I think that people who buy Strand magazines, if you bought Strand magazines in the 70s, they were running you about $100 and $120 a piece, and then in the 80s they were about $200, and in the 90s they were $300, and now, you know, sometimes I see Strand magazines going for $600 for an individual, depending on condition.
Yeah.
But just knowing what's there and sticking to it and trying to, I don't know. Did that ramble on enough?
No, that's understand. And one adjunct question there.
Sure.
Now, everyone has the ability to become an expert in their field by virtue of access to the internet. You know, you can find out anything about anything and get as narrow a niche as you want or as broad and surface level as you like, too. How did you educate yourself along the way in the days before the internet, if we can talk of such things? And how did you become educated on these particular subject areas?
A lot of research and reading and delving into, you know, looking at old back catalogs. I mean, I started out, I remember in 1994, I think it was, I was at an antique dealer, and this guy had some really cool stuff, and I asked him where he got his stuff, and he said a little place called EBAY. I said, EBAY, I never heard of it. So he said, oh, it's international. And it was, so I went home and I joined eBay. But before eBay, I had I subscribed to every catalog, Janus and David Kirby and all the great catalogs that, you know, that were coming out that were especially Sherlock Annie related. I would get those. I would research prices. I would research. I made lists. I think that I had handwritten lists. I had a list of books that I wanted and prices and things that there. So, reading and being diligent, doing your due diligence is really the best way that, you know, you're going to learn a subject. I'm lucky. I have a pretty weird memory. I remember lots of little details. So there was a point where I had about 8,000 or 9,000 books, and I could still remember every book that I had. Wow. And where I bought them and all this stuff. It's kind of gotten gray as I got older, but now, you know, I sometimes buy books that I didn't know I had and I have them, but knowing and spending enough time doing the research, whether it's online, whether it's physical copy or going and talking to people, I think, you know, conversation and communication is the best way of doing it.
Mm. Couldn't have said it better ourselves. Well, this has been just wonderful spending the hour or so chatting with you and hearing your personal take on all of the stuff. I know the beauty of talking with a collector is, A, you know, obviously the passion. That's got to be there. And we know, we mentioned that at the beginning of the show, and we know every collector that's with us is really passionate about what they do. But, you know, the personal touches that you shared with us and your own experience, your own journey, I think that's part of what makes the world of Sherlock Holmes and Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts that much more interesting, is how we really bring our own flavor to it. And I think you've done that extraordinarily well.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, fascinating. It's a whole other world. I had no idea.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing what you can do. You collect things that you can't read.
Well, you know, we could say the same about Jerry Margolin, since he collects images, yeah. You know.
Hey, you know, there's a pageant that's up for auction in June.
I know. Stay tuned. So, well, Don, thanks for being with us, and we'll certainly see you at the next BSI weekend at the very least.
I will be there.
Ah, that's great.
Fabulous.
What a great guy Don is. You know, I've like you said, I sat with him at one of my first BSI dinners back in the mid-90s or so, and always struck me as obviously very affable and gregarious and someone you want to be around. You know, he makes you feel good about not only what he does, but what about what it is that you bring to the table too. That's special. Mm.
Well, yeah, and he's, you know, he's very involved from a community and fellowship standpoint. You know, it's more than just the pursuit of things on a shelf. It's an opportunity to connect with people. As he was saying, when he travels, looks people up. You know, if you have one, gloat. If you have two, share. So there's a lot of give and take there. It's a wonderful corner of this kind of enthusiasm that doesn't get enough attention. Really interesting.
I know. And the fact that he actually started at the feet of the master, you know, John Bennett Shaw, you know, master collector, but also a master in going around and visiting people and, you know, kind of operating the world of Sherlock Holmes like a giant Rotary Club, as it were.
Yeah.
So couldn't have done worse.
No, absolutely. But, you know, I would never be able to collect Holmes in translation, because at 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning, I would wake up convinced that somewhere in one of those editions, there'd be a typo. And I would have no way of knowing.
Oh.
And it would drive me crazy.
And you might have to reach for a certain implement around your fireplace.
Oh,
right?
Yes. Friends, exercise is more important than ever. That's why you need the Sherlock Holmes brand fireplace poker. Just grab each end and bend it in the middle for a full body workout. It's the only fireplace poker that delivers the three C's, challenging chest compression. So tone your muscles the Roylott way. Ask for the Sherlock Holmes brand fireplace poker at your dealers today.
I have to get one of those. No question. Well, of course, in addition to our Sherlock Holmes brand advertising, we have some other great people and organizations that make this show possible. Of course, one of our longest standing sponsors is none other than the Wessex Press. You can find them at wessexpress.com. And they are the proprietors of that fine online bookstore that publishes all sorts of things related to the world of Sherlock Holmes, audio, visual, written. And I think there probably isn't a better single collection there than the Sherlock Holmes Reference Library. These are, if you're familiar with the new annotated Sherlock Holmes by Les Klinger, this is basically an expanded version of that, where you have even more annotations and even more in-depth scholarship related to the original story. So you'll get 10 volumes. It's all the 9 original volumes of the canon, plus the apocrypha of Sherlock Holmes, things like The Lost Special and The Man with the Watches, and things like that, in addition to all of that great commentary and scholarship in footnotes and endnotes along the way. So check that out at wessexpress.com. Mm.
And I think there's work afoot, isn't there, to translate that into Urdu?
I would hope so, for at least Don's sake.
That's
if
right.
No one else's.
One special edition, but all the footnotes mysteriously will be in Mandarin, so you won't be able to really align anything.
That's rough.
And also, Audible.com, for you, the happy listeners of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a 30-day free trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. And you can find just about anything you are interested in when it comes to Sherlock Holmes, including Las Aventuras de Sherlock Holmes, The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, in Spanish. So you can follow Don's enthusiasm for the canon and translation into audible.com. And if you're in the midst of learning a language, like French or Spanish as an example, that's a wonderful addition to your studies.
You better be careful, Bert. I think we may have given Don another area to actually pursue if he wasn't aware of this one.
Oh.
And the Baker Street Journal, fine world-leading publication of Sherlockian scholarship since 1946, published quarterly, plus a Christmas annual. I'm proud to say that I just received my copy of the spring edition of the Baker Street Journal. As usual, it is chock full of great scholarship, a recap of everything that happened during the BSI weekend. So if you're curious about exactly what goes on during the BSI weekend and you didn't get your fill from what Bert and I shared with you a couple of episodes ago, then run right out and buy the Baker Street Journal. It's a very reasonable price for, you know, what should be the cornerstone of every Sherlockian's library. And with the West Express and with the Baker Street Journal, please let them know that you heard their advertising on our show. It means a great deal to us, and it will mean a great deal to them if you make the connection. So get on over to BakerStreetJournal.com, get yourself a subscription, get a gift subscription for somebody you know, and help to keep green the memory mm-hmm. of Sherlock Holmes.
Mm-hmm. Well said.
Well, newsy type stuff. Do we have any news in the world of Sherlock Holmes lately?
An enormous amount of news, and you can find a lot of it, of course, at I Hear of Sherlock everywhere, ihearofsherlock.com. But the most recent news includes a visit to a single large airy sitting room, cheerfully furnished. As it said in Study in Scarlet, a visit to 221B Baker Street as it has been recreated in Reading, Pennsylvania, of all places.
Yeah, Denny Dobry's home in Reading, Pennsylvania. Bob Steck, one of our newer correspondents, went down there, took a series of, probably a score or so of photos, and it's really remarkable. I don't know if folks have had a chance to travel there, but it is one of the great recreations of the sitting room overall.
And there have been, in addition to the things that you can find it, ihearofsherlock.com. The other news is, of course, there has been a spring meeting of the Sons of the Copper Beeches in Philadelphia on April the 25th. And we had two papers. One, one was by Hartley Nathan from Canada, who presented a great paper on Dr. Mortimer's Penang Lawyer. And the other, fascinating, presented by Ernest Burnaby, on Clothes Make the Man, on the Sherlockian Wardrobe in Victorian England. It was a great meeting.
That's fantastic.
And then today we had a meeting in Hoboken of the Hoboken Free State group that Terry Hunt and Linda Hunt have been managing, that commemorate a recognized science society of the Baker Street Irregulars devoted to keeping green the memory of Christopher Morley. And had a very nice turnout for that. In a part of New Jersey that was very special to Morley, because in the 1920s he was involved in theatrical ventures there, which I'm sure we'll talk about at some time in the future.
Mm. Fantastic. Well, you should also know that coming up next month, June 19th in New York, Christie's is auctioning off a number of things, but included in that very special auction are the original manuscript for Black Peter, which is one of 32 known manuscripts of the canon still in existence, and an illustration, an original Paget illustration from Silver Blaze, where Sherlock Holmes is leaning forward in the train cab with his deerstalker on. He's sketching something out on his palm, and Watson is sitting across from him looking intently at him. So it's one of the most iconic images of the two. So between the manuscript and the original Paget, there will be some serious coin dropped. Coin of the realm on June 19th in New York. So we are looking for some of the original images. We've been in touch with the management at Christie's to get some high-res images of these items to share those on iHearOfSherlock.com. So stay tuned as that is poised to come out sometime in the next couple of weeks.
Very good.
Yeah. So always lots of good stuff to browse and sluice through at our site. Check it out. We would love to hear from you in a comment on our Facebook page, certainly, but right there on every single post, we make it possible for you to drop some knowledge on us. So let us know. And if there's anything that you would like us to cover, if you would like to become a correspondent for us, feel free to let us know. There are ways to contact us there on the site. You'll see there's a form you can fill out if you'd like to actually join the editorial staff. We would be delighted to have you on board because, like Sherlock Holmes, we are only good as our band of irregulars that are our eyes and ears and help us out with all these kinds of things. Well, I'm feeling like it's kind of that time.
No, Bert. You're kidding.
Yes, it's the time for the editor's gas lamp. And as we always do, we turn to the pages of yesteryear, or yesterday in some cases, and pull out some kind of written treatise and read it to you, our dear listeners, because, well, I don't know why we do it. We've just been doing it that way for so long. It's become part of the part of the program. Typically, what we tried to do is we try to sift back through the archives of the Baker Street Journal, pick out some of the great editorials, which were called Editor's Gas Lamps, still are. Edgar Smith, obviously, was very talented in this regard as a writer. And when we read his pieces, I think it's something special. But of course, when we have a theme show or when there's something unique to cover, we turn to other sources as well. You'll recall that earlier this year, we had Ray Betzner read one of Vincent Sterrett's works. And is that right, or did we have Vincent read it himself? I'm trying to think back.
Oh, we had Vincent, but I think we also didn't we ask Susan to read 221B?
That's yeah. What it was, something along those lines. So at any rate, since we had Don with us tonight, and since Don had a column on SherlockPeoria.net for about a decade called The Maniac Collector, we thought we'd ask Don to sift back through his archives and pick out something that was relevant to him and read one of those. So, Don, take it away.
This is from the archive. Just happens to be number 333, and it came out in January the 11th of 2009. And this is an article I wrote called The Anti- Peter Principle. The Peter Principle was devised through the power of observation by Dr. Lawrence J. Peter and Raymond Hull and reported in their 1968 book of the same title. Basically, the principle stated that in a hierarchy, every employee tends to rise to their level of incompetence. Dr. William Corican, not to be confused with the former editor of the Baker Street Journal, William Cochran, concluded that anything that works will be used in progressively more challenging application until it fails. This is the generalized Peter principle. This brings me to my theory of the anti-Peter principle. The Peter in question is our own Peter Blau, the same Peter Blau who was once the editor himself of the Baker Street Journal. Whoa, you say. What's the matter with Peter Blau? Why are you against him? What has he ever done to you, you may ask? My answer is simple. Nothing. It is my own observation that if the Peter principle is all about incompetency, then it only goes to reason that the anti-Peter principle is just the opposite. I have been a lucky Sherlockian these past 2 weeks as I've been able to dine with Peter Blau and both of them. I have observed that the more one is around Peter, the better Sherlockian one becomes. Thus, the anti-Peter principle. This week, my work sent me to Washington, D.C. I had already made arrangements to meet Peter at his home in Bethesda, Maryland. So at the prescribed time, or at least as fairly close as possible, I walked up the front steps. This was actually my second time to visit Peter at his present house. The first trip was Peter's house can be read by going back to the Maniac Collector's archive inbox of September the 10th, 2006, Sherlocking in Maryland. There's still an earlier version called when I visited Peter when he was still living in the district. Read Sherlocking in Washington, D.C. on October 26, 2004. Every time I'm around him, I learn something Sherlockian I did not know before. Of course, this time was no different. I am not the only Sherlockian who has noted that Peter has gotten better with age. Peter's significant other, Bev Wolf, and Bev's daughter, Samantha, and a plethora of cats all greeted me as though I was part of the family. We all plied into my rented Kia and drove to the local Italian restaurant. There, we had a wonderful time sharing all of our travel stories. Bev had been trying to get Peter to take her to Italy, so I was able to tell them all about my most recent trip there. Between Peter, Bev, and myself, we have covered nearly everywhere except South America. Upon returning to Peter's house, I ask innocently enough about anything new and exciting in his collection. With that twinkle in his eye, Peter told me that he had added a new room to his house. My powers of observation may not be up to the masters, but I could see nothing outwardly added to the house. Peter and Bev took me into the foyer where they showed me Peter's 75th birthday present from Bev. It was a miniature room, but not a recreation of the sitting room at 221B. But a miniature synopsis of Peter's life. The miniature looked to be about 24 by 12 by 9. It was full of the most amazing items, from a cheetah, because he had once owned one while living in Africa, to a picture of a 57 Chevrolet Biscayne, which he'd also owned at one time. There was plenty of Sherlockian items, including many one-of-a-kind that Bev had commissioned. The miniatures took 2 years to complete, and I do not have enough time or space here to describe everything. Suffice to say that if you are ever lucky enough to visit Peter, you can be amazed on your own. You might even come up with your own anti-Peter principle. Happy collecting.
Well, that was nice for a change.
It was wonderful, and it's a whole other view of these kinds of relationships, as well as somebody you know we both know very well, Peter. And I thought it was a lovely twist on the Peter principle.
I know, and you know you can go and look through those back issues of the Maniac Collector, and we'll have a link to that. To some of the other earlier articles that Don talked about in the actual reading there in the show notes. So you can check out Don's writing, because it did take place on a weekly basis over the course of 10 years. So you've probably got about 500 pieces to go through there, which is pretty significant when you think about it. It's probably a publication in and of itself just waiting to be had there.
And to all of you who've heard all this, we'd like to know what you collect. Now that you have heard Don Hobbs' story, surely that should remove any hesitation you might have about sharing your own enthusiasms, should you think they may have gone to extremes. So Well, we'd love to hear what you all collect, Sherlockian-wise or not.
Yeah, it does remove hesitation, but don't call me Shirley.
That's right.
And if you'd like to see what a real collector's library looks like, we will have images of Don's library up on the site for this episode, episode 64, as well as some of those unusual representations of the Hound of the Baskervilles from Hungary and elsewhere, as Don described. So check it out. But, you know, it's when we talk about these collections, because you know, Don mentioned Bennett Shaw mentioning gloating when you have one of something, but I don't think it's gloating as much as it is just joy in sharing the collection with others.
Yeah.
You know, to be miserly about it and to hoard something for your own, well, that's one thing. But I think most collectors that we've come across just derive great joy in sharing their collection with others.
Yeah, I agree, and that's an important part of what this kind of enthusiasm is all about.
Yeah. So share your collections with us. Let us know what it is. Even if you only have a handful of things, or if you're just getting started, let us know. Or if you have questions about collecting, you know, I'm sure our community would be more than happy to answer any questions like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the only question I have left at this point, Bert, is,
yes,
is it time?
It certainly seems like it's time.
Oh, then I guess I say you're Bert Walder.
That's how did you know? Holmes, you amaze me.
It was the time.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. And you must be Scott Monty.
Ah, and that means it's time to say the
game's
afoot.
You know, I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I'm neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.